home, it demodulates it to audio, probably digitally, takes that digital audio, remodulates that onto a link transmitter, and then transmit on the link. What could cause an interruption of that system on the remote base? Over to you, Eric.
No, it isn't really a remote base. It's a translator. No, I want to see if his signal is strong enough there. Come on. I'll listen to one of the remote receivers. I haven't done that.
That's a fun thing to do. Roy, you're back on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. Hopefully someday we'll come up with the answer. Unfortunately, it's not going to be worth a Nobel Prize, but it'll make me happy, camper, if someone figures out why I stopped, why I'm dropping, and therefore how I could not drop. Then I maybe even can go back to my Flex 6700, which I really love.
Yeah, you can do that. Yeah, late feedback. Although I think I saw you drop out just a moment ago.
Well, you'll know better than I, because I'm not listening to my signal. I'm kind of balancing a bunch of balls simultaneously, and I'll listen to the recording after the fact. But I don't know what to tell you. Once again, I could sort of understand if it was only the Flex that we'd say it's the Flex, and that would be the end of it. But it's not the Flex. It's not the ICOM. It's me, UFOs. I don't know.
This is very strange. As you're talking, I'm seeing the COR on the remote receiver drop. Carrier on the remote receiver drop. Although the leader is listening to Glenn Elf, I'm not hearing it here, which is further away from you.
His last two transmissions had no dropout in the 8.5 output that I could hear, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was listening to both at the same time, making the confusion, but, no, I was looking at the S meter on the radio. Like, while I'm transmitting right now, I'm getting about, constantly up. While he was talking, it would disappear for a moment. It would go down to, S1 or S0 when the smoke transmitter drops. By the way, the propagation delay between the time it hears a signal and the time it turns the transmitter on is about 100 milliseconds, so.
I think you're talking about the pickup latency right now. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I had the remote receivers set so there's no squelch tail on them. Otherwise, it would hang up the whole system. So, if the carrier should drop momentarily, transmitter's carrier, will go off for that duration. When it comes back on, the transmitter's going to come back on, and that's what I'm seeing. Okay, well, keep going.
Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, well, I appreciate the interest in fixing my problem. I think we really should get to Paul because he has the space report. I just want to once again mention to people that I'm going to put links to everything mentioned, to an article that Paul is going to talk about, to the list from the ARRL about automobile F, and all the stories that I mentioned will be up on roy.ac2gs.com. And if anyone has any comments, the topics, questions, answers, refutations, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And thank you very much, Dick, and on to you, Paul.
Thank you, Roy. Great stuff. WS2N with the space report. Number 183. Go right ahead, Paul.
K2LIW
in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm up to, what do we got here? 313. We're up to 313. The weeks are flying by. The Orion heat shield has now been installed onto the Orion spacecraft. This is called our EM1 mission. That's going to be the exploration mission number one, which will be the one that will actually go to the moon for a couple of weeks and then come back without a crew. So that's ways away, but I mean they're getting that little by little. The heat shield consists of many different parts, and they bolt together. They said there was 68 bolts to install this thing, but everything, you know, had to line up perfectly, and then they coat it with paint, and they put aluminum tape on it, and then they get it ready to go. 16.5 feet diameter, and it will eventually carry a crew of four once they get the thing into operation to their actually first manned mission will probably be to the moon, and that's a couple of years away, probably 2022. But right now they're leading up to the first test mission, and there's two of them coming up. This one that's going to go to the moon for a couple of weeks and back unmanned. That's what I was just talking about. And now there's another one coming up this April called the AA-2 mission. That's what they're going to do is they're going to simulate an abort after launch. So they're going to take one of these Orion capsules that was, in this case, it's again, going to be unmanned, but it's a duplicate of what they will eventually fly, and they plan on launching it out of Launch Complex 46 down in Florida in April. So it's going to be on not a SLS booster, not the Space Launch System booster. That's not the one they're going to launch on. They're going to send it on another piece because this is just a suborbital flight. They want to get it up to about 6 miles. They're going to be going, you know, like Mark 2. And then they plan on using the launch abort system. They call it the LAS, the LAS launch abort system, which is a rocket attached to the front of Orion, which would pull the crew away in case of an emergency. So this should be pretty interesting. Next April, they'll naturally have that on TV. That's all NASA flight. Orion spacecraft is being built by Lockheed. LAS launch abort system is built by Orbital ATK. Now it's called Northrop Grumman, but Orbital ATK built this thing, and it will create 500,000 pounds of thrust to pull the spacecraft away from the launch vehicle in case of an emergency. It has attitude controls on it after it separates. That will come into play to try to keep the spacecraft steady. And eventually it will go back into the water, into the Atlantic Ocean. So NASA is plugging along. They have equipment. They have tanks being made. They have first stages, second stages being made. The Orion spacecraft, and quite a few of those have been created. One of them, they actually tested the heat shield a couple of years ago in December. That was 2014, I guess four years ago, and that was launched by a Delta Heavy. That was very successful. You know, went around 3,000 miles out into space and then came back at very high speed. In fact, they had a rocket behind it to duplicate what it would be doing coming back from the moon or Mars, and that was just to prove out the heat shield and some other avionics. So in a couple of years, probably like I said, 2022 or so, that would be the earliest flight for people on that. So looking forward to that. But in the meantime, there's other manned projects that are going on that will launch our astronauts from our soil, from America, next year. So they are working on the Dragon launch. It's not the Dragon crew vehicle will be launched from Launch Complex 39A in Florida by SpaceX, and they now have their walkway. It's an arm, it's a crew access arm, now installed a couple hundred feet in the air. It's actually higher than where the space shuttle arm used to be. And that's where your crew will eventually walk out. And once they're in regular operation, you'll have like four people at a time going up to the space station. So you'll have four astronauts going along this 85-foot long walkway that will eventually retract right before launch. And that's actually considered a big deal. Another walkway is already completed by Boeing over at Launch Complex 41. And the reason for that one is because Boeing is building the Starliner, which will also be sending crews of four up to the International Space Station. So between SpaceX and Boeing, they'll take turns. They'll send four up, and then 6 months later, the other company will send four up, and so on and so forth. So looking forward to that. Both companies will have unmanned flights probably early spring. When I say an unmanned flight, it will be the exact same thing as manned flight. The only thing is that I'm going to put people in it, in the spacecraft. It will launch from, in SpaceX's case, from Launch Complex 39A, fly up to the International Space Station dock for a couple of weeks, and then separate, come back, and land in the Pacific Ocean. In the case of Starliner, which is being built by Boeing, that will launch on the Atlas V rocket, which has launched 100 times from either Florida or from California. Very successful rocket. They're going to put people on that with two solid boosters, second stage will actually have two engines, which they've always had one, but that's what they're going to need for the manned version. And that will launch an uncrewed crew to the space station, just like SpaceX docked to the International Space Station. A couple of weeks on dock, and then come back and not land in the Pacific Ocean, but probably land, they're looking at Utah or maybe White Sands, New Mexico. It will be landing on solid ground. Now the heat shield's going to separate, and it's going to expose all these big airbags. And that's how the Starliner will return to Earth. So before I go on to another topic, any questions on this? This is WS2N. Okay. I believe Roy was going to bring this up, but I had it as well. This has to do with finding ice on the moon. Now, they've pretty much confirmed that there's, ice there, but they've never definitively, said that it's 100% positive. They think it's on the south pole and the north pole of the moon. But researchers using the Indian spacecraft that's been in orbit around the moon for almost, 10 years now. It's called the Chandrayaan 1 spacecraft. Chandrayaan is a spacecraft that launched in 2008, and it has this detector on board, a moon meteorological mapper, which is, sends signals down to the moon, and it reflects back up. And whatever they're using, the researchers have concluded after, many, many orbits of the moon, they look at this research and finally have figured out that it's definitely ice that they're looking at, buried craters of the moon, mostly on the south pole, but also on the north pole. Which, of course, will help in the future. If you set up a base on the South Pole, you'll be able to possibly get this ice that's buried in the depths of these craters out. And once you have ice, you have water. Probably be able to eventually drink it. You'll also be able to separate it to hydrogen and oxygen, create fuel for not only powering up maybe a station on the moon, but actually powering up a rocket in the far future. So that was interesting. Another company developing a lander that will land on the moon. This is a company called Astrobotica. Astrobotica, I've talked about before, but bringing them up again because now NASA is throwing extra money into this company to push them along. They're developing the Peregrine. It's called the Peregrine Lunar Lander, and they plan on sending eventually multiple flights to the moon over the time, and eventually with bigger landers. But for now, it's just a lander, land in one spot, and it does have a rover attached to it. It would lower the rover to the moon's surface, and in fact, it actually has two rovers, and they'll be able to do some good science with that. But NASA's pushing them along, and they gave them, $10 million or so to push their project. They have a contract already to launch to the moon with the United Launch Alliance, and they plan on launching about a year and a half from now, 2020. They plan on launching on another Atlas V rocket, the same rocket that will eventually launch people from Launch Complex 41. That's the United Launch Alliance. Again, a very safe rocket. This company, Astrobotica, really has their faith put into the Atlas V, so that's what they're going to send for a ride. What they'll probably do is not a big lander, so it actually will be a secondary mission, part of the mission. So United Launch Alliance will probably launch the Atlas V, maybe with a cargo vehicle, like the Cygnus cargo vehicle that goes up to the International Space Station. They'll separate with that payload, and then attached to second stage will be this Peregrine lander. They'll separate the control ring from the spacecraft, let that burn up, and then the second stage will turn around, fire its liquid oxygen rocket again, and it'll go to the moon. It'll go to translunar ejection, TLI they call it, and send this lander all the way to the surface of the moon. So what I'm getting at is there's a lot of private companies involved, and one right after the other. Some have gone away, and some are still here, and the ones that are still here are progressing. Within a couple of years, I think we're going to see quite a bit of commercial flights. We see it already, but we're going to see a lot more from companies that we don't even know about that are not really advertised that much. The FAA just approved another spaceport. This time it's going to be in Colorado. It's going to be east of Denver. When I lived in Denver, they had Stapleton International Airport there back in the 70s. Well, eventually they leveled that whole airport and built another airport further away from it, which is kind of strange. But then now east of this new airport, there's an older airport, and it's called the Front Range Airport, but now they wanted to eventually call it the Colorado Airmen Spaceport. To make a long story short, the FAA has now approved this place to actually test rockets and even test rocket engines. There's a company in England that is now contracted with this particular airport in Colorado to bring their engine, it's called the Spray engine, over to the United States where they can do some further testing, because now DARPA is involved with this thing. The Spray engine is really a hypersonic engine. What they plan on doing with it is essentially creating a vehicle. It's going to be called Skylon, but this vehicle will have the capability of launching like a jet with two big engines, regular jet engine. The only difference is it will be using hydrogen for fuel, and it will be using air for oxygen. And they plan on getting up to hypersonic speeds, roughly 5 times the speed of sound. Now, with these two engines, they will eventually transit over to rocket engines. So, the same two engines. Eventually, they'll close off the intakes, no more air coming in, and the hydrogen lines will be now fed liquid oxygen from this vehicle. So that's Skyline. It's been under development for many years in Europe, but there's no vehicle right now, but they're still working on the engine. Spray engine, they call it. The acronym for synergetic air-breathing rocket engine. So, you know, combining an air-breathing and a rocket engine into one. They could do something like this. Now it's going to take off like a plane from a runway and eventually land like a plane. They think they could probably double the amount of cargo that goes up to the space station if they wanted to from the heaviest vehicle that goes up there. The heaviest one that brings up the most payload now is actually from Japan. In fact, they have one launching in September. They usually go up once a year. They bring up like 23,000 pounds of food, clothes, science equipment. They're going to be bringing up all these extremely heavy lithium-ion batteries. You know, each one weighs like 400 pounds. They're going to bring up a couple of dozen of those things. So that's on a flight from Japan. I think the seventh flight. So they've done this roughly 7 years in a row now. Naturally, no people on board, but, you know, it goes up there autonomously. It gets near the International Space Station. Eventually, it gets grabbed by the astronauts on board the space station with this 57-foot robotic arm, and they attach to the space station. They berth with one of the existing modules that are there. They leave it there for maybe 6 months or so and fill it up with dirt, junk, and garbage, and eventually deorbit it over the Pacific. This is WS2M. Just want to get to this one subject that I left a link to on roy.ac2gs.com website. This is, they call it the Aeolus satellite mission. Aeolus is the satellite. It was launched by a Vega satellite from French Guiana, from South America. It went up last week. And what the satellite does, it measures the wind speed and the direction of wind on a global scale. It's in a polar orbit. So it'll be looking down at Earth a couple hundred miles up. And it's going to be looking down and firing a laser, ultraviolet laser, at the ground. And it'll be hitting the wind molecules, all the atmosphere. And due to the Doppler effect, using ultraviolet laser, depending on what comes back to the spacecraft, they're going to be looking down at it. They've got this, it's over 5 foot diameter mirror attached to the Aeolus spacecraft. So let's call it a 5 foot mirror. I'm looking down, so as the lasers are coming back up, it's going to be able to detect the movement of the air that it's hitting. So I thought that was interesting. It's never been successfully done before. NASA tried to do it. And they sent up a test experiment, and they attached it to the space station, and it lasted a couple of hours, and then it quit. What happens is the laser gets so hot, they said pinpoint locations sometimes get up to 1,700 degrees, and eventually it fouls up the optics when the signal's coming back on the right before the detector on board this 5 foot telescope. So this company, now this is a European Space Agency deal. This has nothing to do with NASA. It was launched on a Vega spacecraft. which also has nothing to do with NASA. And that's the Vega rocket is built by Italy, launched out of French Guiana, South America. So now this thing's up in the air, and they said it's already starting to work. But the problem that they had to overcome was the optics would get so hot they would actually get deformed or discolored. And the reason for it is that there's little carbohydrate molecules, you know, microscopic, that eventually get on the detectors. No matter how clean these spacecraft are before they go up, when they get heated by the sun, there's little molecules that come off and wind up on the optics. When the laser comes back up and hits it, essentially it's turning it black. So what they've done is they've put a couple of tanks, and each tank, they said it's around 30 pounds each, filled with oxygen, pure oxygen. And every now and then they release an extremely small amount of oxygen, I mean, to the point where it's like the amount of oxygen that comes off of a plant. And because the laser come down back and hit this, if there's any carbohydrates or any material on the optics, it automatically gets burnt up and disappears. And with all the oxygen that they have up there, this thing can go for years and years and years. So, you know, with some of the satellites that have been canceled by the United States, you know, for global warming and all of that, at least it's being made up by different entities, in this case, the European Space Agency is heavily involved with you know, the atmosphere and global warming and all of that. So that was pretty good. And then we have a satellite. NASA is sending a satellite up very shortly from California. And they have a laser on board too, but it's not ultraviolet. It's infrared, and that's going to be looking at the ice level around the world. You know, they'll be able to look at Greenland and tell within the distance of the diameter of a pencil, you know, how much ice is there today and tomorrow and the day after that and so on and so forth. So that was scheduled many years ago to go up, and it's finally going up. It will be flying on the very last Delta II rocket that we're sending up. Delta II has been a workhorse for decades, sending all kinds of spacecraft up, including the Mars rovers that have gone to Mars, such as Spirit and Opportunity. So Delta II is going to be retired. But if you want to read about this Vega and the ALS spacecraft and their telescope, the 5-foot diameter telescope with this laser that's shooting ultraviolet light down to the atmosphere, I sent the link over to Roy, and Roy was gracious enough to put it onto his website, and that's roy.ac2gs.com. It's good reading. It's amazing that humans have the capability to do this, to look at the wind on a global basis from day to day and see which way the winds are going. But now, you know, we've been able to do it. How do we do it? We send airplanes up, and they send balloons, and which way the balloon's going. In fact, that's how they're calibrating this thing, you know, as we speak. They'll be checking measurements, and then they will be flying planes and balloons and making sure that this thing is working fine. So that was pretty good. This is WS20. Any questions or comments for the space portion of the TechNet? You know, there's a couple of things we can cover, but as we hold them over to next week. Comments or questions? Okay, we have nothing, but alright, that's it. I mean, you know, talk about the OSIRIS-REx mission that launched a couple of years ago, and that's almost to the asteroid Bennu, and you. The goal there is to get very close to it and eventually orbited. It's only 1,500 feet in diameter. Plan on orbiting this thing and eventually getting very close to the surface and getting some couple of grams of material off the surface. Arm that's going to reach out. Essentially, it's like a vacuum cleaner on one side, and it's going to push out nitrogen on the other side, and it's going to disturb the asteroid, and whatever stuff is going to blow off the surface will get caught by this big catcher's mitt kind of thing, and then it will be eventually put into a spacecraft with a heat shield on it. And quite a few years from now, I believe 2025, it will be landing in Utah. Let the scientists evaluate it. It's going to be at this asteroid a long time. It's very close now.
Paul, I think I remember that they said that the asteroid is 1,500 meters wide. That means it's a good fraction of a mile. I don't think it was 1,500 feet. I thought it was 1,500 meters. I might be wrong on that one. How about you, Paul? KQRIW.
Yeah, what I say, feet, yeah, it's a 1,500 meter thing. Yeah. But even at that distance, 1,500 meters, it's going to be going so slow around this thing. This is the one that said that they have 1/60,000th of the amount of gravity that we have here. You know, we have 1G, and it's, you know, 1/60,000. So that's incredible. So, that's going to be an interesting mission because, you know, it's going to be there for many years, and so is the Hayabusa mission, also doing a similar type of thing. And that one's by Japan, and that's already at its location. And again, that one's going to spend a couple of years. And that one has a couple of landers. This one doesn't. This has catcher's mitt. I want to call it that. This big ring that's going to go, you know, on an extended arm that's going to go to the asteroid, pick up stuff. Any other questions, Dick, or anybody?
G2RY.
KQYY, go ahead.
Hello there, Paul. How are you? You know, I think about knowledge, you know, scientific knowledge, medical knowledge, any kind of knowledge. Is it possible for knowledge to increase exponentially as opposed to word to word to word to word? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I get an idea what you mean, but I wouldn't be able to answer that. That would be a Roy question. ACTGS would be able to follow something like that better than I would. Knowledge is it's accumulative. That's about all I can tell you. And most important thing to do day after day, especially when you get older, keep it going. Roy, do you have any comments or answers for that station?
You know me, Paul. I always have a comment. By the way, I just want to say hello to JA2SYJ on Echo Link from Tokyo. So we're international here. David, it's kind of problematic to say if it's linear, geometric, or logarithmic, because you're talking kind of metaphors. But there are certain scientific discoveries that change the entire background. You know, when relativity was first discovered, there was a lot of research, a lot of papers, and a lot of revolutionary new concepts. And you can say that that was an exponential growth, whereas before that, things like thermodynamics were a progressive study before you have things that are generally called paradigm shifts that just move everything into a weird direction, like quantum mechanics. There's loads of examples out there.
Yeah, but, you know, if it's word to word to word, you know, it's usually something that is already known, you know? So it sort of doesn't move along so quickly. When you get into something like the unknown, something bigger, something more universal, then it qualifies for exponential growth. You know, I think the limitation is what we know, and what we don't know is the possibility. Go ahead.
Well, words are one thing, but mathematics is somewhat a little bit different. I mean, if you have nothing better to do, you know, listen to things like Hamiltonian operators and matrix math and all kinds of fun stuff that makes absolutely no written sense. You can't just kind of write down in words what that is. So some things defy simple words, and so there are concepts that are fundamental that, yeah, you can string words together, E equals MC square, but it's a fundamental change in your underlying concept where energy was one, matter was different thing, and they weren't interrelated until recently. So again, I would not say exponential or logarithmic, but I would say the rate of discoveries changes and are unpredictable.
Well, I wasn't saying discoveries. I'm saying the infinite knowledge. You know, it's like the growth of the knowledge. You know, it moves in a much steeper curve, you know? It's like when you talk about consciousness and knowledge is more of the unknown. It's sort of like being so totally in the present moment, but also not knowing what is going to come next, you know? So there's an element of surprise and magic, sort of like the waking dream. The waking dream is consciousness. Go ahead.
WS2N, one comment before we go on.
Yes, Paul, comment away. It's your segment.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if that station in Japan was going to make a transmission or a question. You know, I brought up the Kanatori launch vehicle. That's the one that's going to be launching from Japan next month to the International Space Station. So, Kanatori is Japanese, some kind of a bird or something. I think it's a swan or something of that nature. That's where they get the name. But it's bringing thousands of pounds, like 20,000 pounds of stuff to the space station. Does he want to make a transmission, or he's just on the chat room, Roy?
No, he was on Echo Link just listening to the transmission, and he dropped off during our exchange about the infinities of the universe. So he's gone now. People check in, check out. We've had people in Australia, New Zealand, had people in Denmark over the last few months. So people outside of the United States know about us.
Oh, yeah. When I first got that running system, I remember when Dick was talking at the time, and it was a check-in from New Zealand. So that was the beginning of that when they really got involved with. I don't remember if that was Echo Link or not, but that was pretty cool. So, you know, I think he was from the States, but he was there and he goes back and forth or something. New Zealand. Very good, Roy. All right. Did you want to say anything else further about that topic? Back to you, Roy.
I've got a little bit of a comment on the subject of the rate of change of knowledge, Roy. When the U.S. colonies wrote the Declaration of Independence and mailed it to the United Kingdom, it had to be carried there by ship, and I'm guessing that document took a couple of months to get there. A decision was made, and some number of months later, they declared war, and we had the War of Independence. Nowadays, a document like that could be sent by email, not in months, but in milliseconds. As far as human beings are concerned, in London versus New York, the message gets there instantaneously. Mankind makes a lot of progress by people talking to each other. The rate at which they can talk back and forth is one of the great big variables, and the number of people they can address all at one time. You pose a message on one of the modern-day networks where it goes viral, and a million people can see that message all at once. Think about trying to do that in 1776. So the rate...
Repeater, time out.
So the rate at which we derive and transmit data today is thousands of times faster than it was in 1776. That's just an example I'm suddenly thinking of. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Well, that's true, but it's not necessarily good. It's what you do with it. I often use the metaphor that a hammer can build a house or bash someone's skull in. Up-to-date information can be incredibly useful, very effective. Certainly, it's valuable in financial markets. Sometimes, though, it could lead to things escalating faster than they should and getting people into trouble. So it depends upon the situation, but, you know, unless there's some terrible calamity, be going back. You can get communications across the world, and again, it's not quite pornography that's driving it. I think it's the financial markets, because if you can shave a few milliseconds off of transactions, you could make millions of dollars. So it's just going to get shorter and shorter. The world is going to shrink down to a pinpoint.
I'm having trouble picturing a world that's shrunk down to a pinpoint. I'm not quite sure what you mean by that one, Roy. Yes, the world is getting smaller, but a pinpoint? How many people can you put on the point of a pin now, Roy?
Oh, how many angels? But I'm doing hyperbole, obviously. But communication, transportation, all of these things that we now take for granted would mystify and amaze our great-great-grandparents. It's just the world is a smaller place, metaphorically.
Okay. Maybe we should get back to Paul. Paul, have you come to the end of your particular piece of material, WS2M, K2RIW?
Okay, yeah. I mean, I was going to mention one other private company. You know, that's what I was really getting at in the beginning. There's so many private companies and private spaceports throughout the country. We have another one in Camden, Georgia, that's been used. Here's another one, the Spaceport America. They had a launch last week by a company called Exos. I mean, these companies don't make it to the news, but Exos has just launched not orbital yet, but soon to be, but it's called SARGE. SARGE is the suborbital autonomous rocket with guidance E on it. And that, you know, they're working on an orbital one, but they tested a suborbital flight from Spaceport America, which is located in New Mexico. New Mexico, back in the 90s, built this whole massive place. They thought it was going to be utilized much more than it has been, but I think they were about 20 years ahead of the game. They've had all kinds of problems with taxes and everything else, but now the funding is starting to pay off. There's companies coming in. Virgin Galactic is building their own facility there and hangars, and they're going to be taking off from there within a year. Anxious to see what's going to happen now with all these private companies and private spaceports all over the states and all over the world for that matter. There's going to be one in Scotland. They plan on launching 2,000 rockets from there. I don't know. WS2N, I probably timed it out. Any other comments or questions?
You absolutely didn't time it out, though, Paul. There's a number of countries, a number of companies, a number of groups of people who are convinced that we're heading for Mars. We're going to put mankind on Mars, either temporarily as a colony or whatever, and we're going to use the moon as a temporary stepping stone. Whoa. It's so easy to say, I'm going to put men on the moon, I'm going to create a colony there. Seems like the vast majority of people who say those words forget about the fact that at high noon on the moon, it goes way above 150 degrees centigrade. That's 50 degrees centigrade above the temperature of boiling water is the general temperature on the moon at high noon, and minus 150 degrees centigrade, which is essentially colder than the Antarctica and the Arctic ever gets, at midnight. The moon goes through that temperature cycle every 28 days. You can't put a man in any reasonable habitat in that kind of heat and that kind of cold and have them survive. So putting men on the moon for anything more than a couple of days without some heroic efforts is out of the question. Everybody seems to forget that. Back to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, I know we're running out of time, but, you know, nuclear power has to be part of it, and multiple systems, you know, nuclear, a couple of different nuclear, you know, if one goes down, the other one has to be capable of continuing, backup, all kinds of backup powers, you know, maybe fuel cells and solar panels, because if one system quits, you can't, and, you know, if it's nighttime, you know, you've got to be able to keep these people toasty at those kind of temperatures, you know, going from a couple hundred degrees minus. And then in the daytime, well, at least we have a shot at that. You know, we've done that before. We've had a spacecraft on the moon for three solid days with two people in there living in a day and night. Very uncomfortable, but they did it, you know. The final mission of Apollo 17 lasted over 3 days. So at least we have a little experience with that thing. Back to you.
NASA very carefully chose the point on the moon midway between high noon and midnight, at twilight, so to speak. And so, depending on whether they're on the right side or the left side of that, let's call it the shadow line, that's not the right word, but you know what I mean. You stay there too long, you're either going to get hit with a hell of a lot more heat or a hell of a lot more cold. So they very carefully landed at a very specific point on the moon, at a very specific longitude. You can't go to the moon at high noon. You can't go to the moon at midnight, so to speak. We're almost out of time. Back to you, Paul. K2LIW.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're looking for the Terminator. That's the word you're looking for. And also they wanted some kind of shadows as they were approaching the moon. They, you know, for landing, if it's high noon and they didn't have any shadows, see the boulders that good, or you wouldn't see the craters. That was another reason for that. So that's pretty much it for the net. Back to you, Dick. I'm going to sign, and then I guess over to Roy. This is WS2N. It's been great. And we're going to miss John McCain. Back to you.
Thank you, Paul. Well done. Roy, for you, any final comments? Thank you also. Very well done. You had quite a few people excited by these mental gymnastics tonight. Over to you, Roy.
Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul. I always like to wax philosophical if I can. And yes, John McCain will be remembered, a great statesman. And maybe next week we'll take back up the subject of Chandrayaan 1 spacecraft. It was launched in 2008 and decommissioned in 2009, and yet it's giving us new information. So there's probably a story behind that. I want to thank everyone for listening, for participating. This is AC2GS. Once again, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com, and the links are all available present at roy.ac2gs.com. Have a great week, guys. Until next week, bye.
And you guys gather all your strange questions you want asked, answered for next week. And this group of guys will make an attempt at it. Bye-bye, you all. K2RIW clear.
The time is 12:04 a.m., 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater. tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you.
tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.